From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, new reporting shows a major Flint City contractor knew the city's water was tainted with lead, but didn't warn the public.
Emails back and forth between the executives at Veolia were, they concerned a lot of things, including this discussion of the lead discovery that was never made public. But they also talk about the potential for having future business with the city of Flint.
Learning more about noise pollution and its effects on our health.
What we're learning, particularly in the last couple decades, is that hearing loss may just be the tip of the iceberg.
Detroit's lost department stores and the demise of the famous downtown Hudson's.
I mean, they tried everything they could right up through the end, but with less people working downtown, less people coming downtown, it just wasn't in the cards.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. And now, the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When we think of pollution, we often think of contaminants in our air and in our water. But how about our ears? Later in the hour, we explore the health impacts of noise pollution. But first, who knew what and when? More than 5 years after the disastrous switch from Detroit water to the Flint River, the people of Flint are still seeking answers to those questions. In other words, accountability. Well, now a joint investigation by MLive journalist Ron Fonger and journalist Emily Holden and Jessica Glenza of The Guardian finds executives from a major city contractor knew people in Flint were at risk of lead in their water, and they didn't warn the public. Ron Fonger is with us now. So we're talking to a company called Veolia. Who is it, and what were they doing in Flint?
Veolia is a large corporation. They do consulting and operations and management in a number of utility areas, including water. And in 2015, in February, they were hired to come to Flint to consult with the city to assess the water system. And at the time, of course, Flint was in violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act because of TTHM in the water. It was having problems with broken lines and bacteria, and people were becoming more and more upset about something being wrong with their water, the discoloration and the smell.
And that so was Veolia, 10 months after the switch happened then?
Right. So even though within a month of the switch to the Flint River having happened, people were complaining about this, but things got increasingly worse with the bacteria and with total trihalomethanes being in the water. And Veolia was brought in. They say that the scope of their contract was limited and that they were trying to help the city in a limited way. And the city indicated that they wanted a top-to-bottom assessment of the water system.
And so as you found out in this investigation, Veolia executives came to suspect the water could be poisoned. And how long was that before the residents were first made aware of the lead in water problem?
Well, it took Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech to come forward and release his own independent analysis of Flint water in September of 2015 before people actually were told just how corrosive the water was and the resulting amount of lead that was coming out. And as I said, Veolia was here in 2015, and their own emails indicate that they were aware of this discussion of lead in the water, specifically at the University of Michigan, where they found some high levels of lead there. In a way, they became like the city government, the county government, the state government, and the federal government, all of which knew that there was elevated levels of lead in Flint's water after it changed to the Flint River, and yet the public never found out until this professor from Virginia Tech came forward several months later and exposed it.
And in your investigation, along with the journalist from The Guardian, you FOIA'd and you fought for internal company emails. So what's the story those emails tell about why Veolia didn't get the word out to the public?
I have to give credit to an organization called Corporate Accountability, which actually originally obtained the documents, which are a public record. They are part of a lawsuit that was filed by the state of Michigan against Veolia and another engineering company. The emails back and forth between the executives at Veolia were, they concerned a lot of things, including this discussion of the lead discovery that was never made public. But they also talk about the potential for having future business with the city of Flint. They talk about resistance from emergency managers and others in the city of Flint to switching back to Detroit Water, despite that being probably the best solution that could have happened at the time.
Your story contains some emails that really, really stick in my mind. I'm going to quote a bit of your story here, Ron Fonger. Veolia Technology Vice President Bill Fahey emailed senior executives calling for the company to advise Flint to change its water supply, adding, quote, "The politics of this should not get in the way of making the best recommendation." Reiterating the call in another email, he added in caps, "Please, this will come back and bite us." And then another Veolia exec wrote to complain that the company's business development department refused to suggest to the city it should switch its water, stop using Flint River. And again came this plea, "Please, this will come back and bite us." So how does the company defend this? What did they say to you as you tried to talk to them for this story?
I worked on this story in concert with a couple of other reporters from The Guardian, Emily Holden and Jessica Glenza. And Emily Holden from The Guardian had the direct conversation with Veolia, but they responded to our questions about this. They say that they warned the city officials about the possibility of lead contamination and that the city resisted discussions about the need to change its water source. They indicate that they did that more than once. And there is evidence to show that they brought up the need for corrosion control, but in the reports that ended up being made public, those same reports, both in person and in writing, didn't indicate that needed to be done because we had a problem and a growing problem with lead in our water.
Yeah, your story says. They never mentioned lead contamination.
Right, and former Mayor Dane Walling indicated this when I talked to him because he was in some meetings with Veolia at the time, and his own notes from that time, his handwritten notes, indicate that they were talking about corrosion control, but he recalls that the discussion was all around doing corrosion control, and their reports indicated, too, that the need to do corrosion control would help with the appearance of the water. There's no indication in the reports out to the public that lead was a growing problem here.
Yeah, and meantime, Veolia, as you point out in your story, was angling for future work with Flint that could have netted a $15 to $30 million annual contract.
They had discussions internally about that. That's part of what the emails show, that an operations management type of an arrangement with the city of Flint could be worth $15 to $30 million a year.
And Veolia was being sued by the state attorney general. And just kind of bring us up to speed where things stand with that suit.
That lawsuit, most elements of that lawsuit, most of the complaints against both Veolia and another engineering firm, LAN, were dismissed by a Genesee County Circuit judge. That just happened a couple of months ago, and we reported on that. Mm-hmm. One element of the case still remains, but when it was looked at by a judge in Genesee County, he did not find that the state, you know, had met its burden in terms of what it was claiming against Veolia. So the lawsuit is still there, but the majority, I think 5 out of the 6 claims that were made by the state have been dismissed.
And meantime, as far as accountability that the people in Flint are looking for, it seems from your story that they're still looking for it.
Yes, that's fair to say.
Ron Fonger, journalist with MLive in the Flint Journal. Thank you so much. It's been very good to talk with you. And as I wrap up my career, I want to thank you for all the great conversations we've had on Stateside.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, and good luck going forward.
Terry Blackhawk has been a force in Detroit poetry for decades. Thanks to Inside Out Literary Arts, the award-winning program she founded in 1995, Thousands of Detroit Public School children have had access to world-class poetry instruction. Stateside contributor John Freeman has his review of Blackhawk's latest collection of poems.
In her fifth book, One Less River, Terry Blackhawk crystallizes her aesthetic vision with a sequence of poems that is at once scientific, elegiac, and musical. Metaphors emerge organically to offer profound insights about the human condition. Take the following lines from Hermit Crabs. "Occasionally it is amusing," one of us announces, antennae clicking, claws barely touching the sand, "to recognize ourselves without these shells and think of the pulpy creatures who used to live inside." The title poem, One Less River, is a heartbreaking elegy for Detroit poet and songwriter David Blair. Blackhawk's words render a myth out of death while questioning the false comfort such myths might offer us. "Last night the moon was a coin, a relief of wings, a scarab beaten gold, rounded or rendered, to place on your eyelids forever now. Today, a darker fuzz belies the sun. How dreary myth becomes." Such lyrical empathy typifies Blackhawk's approach. Take the extinct freshwater mussels of the Detroit River, an elegy for Catherine Lindbergh, the Wayne State University English professor who died by suicide from the Belle Isle Bridge in 2010. Here, the preponderance of ecological loss in our age of the Anthropocene mirrors personal loss. "The self-same river, the self-same self, even the one that knew better, the self that knew better than to pick up a phony $10 bill, folded to disguise some evangelical come hither. Come hither," said the bridge. Here, Blackhawk reminds us that the best elegies don't simply commemorate the dead, but hint at something more. Not the hereafter, exactly. Rather, that which the intellect cannot contain.
That was writer John Freeman with a review of Terry Blackhawk's latest poetry collection, One Less River. Coming up, back in the day, downtown department stores were not just a place to shop for presents. They were at the heart of holiday celebrations.
All of the windows on Woodward Avenue would be animated, appealing to children's fantasies. You'd have a 9-story tree of lights on the Woodward Avenue facade of the building.
The rise and fall of the Great American Department Store next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to talk theater and what's being done by professional theater companies all around the state. And as always, our guide is David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And we're starting at the always interesting Planet Ant in Hamtramck.
Yes. Cynthia, one of the things I really get excited about when I follow Michigan theater is watching young actors, young writers, and new theater companies evolve and grow over time. So there's a young playwright in our midst, Max Vinogradov, and he has made a bit of a name for himself in just a few short years. He's a recent University of Michigan grad, and while he was there, he won 2 $10,000 prizes for his first 2 plays. Not bad for a kid,
not
right?
Not at all.
In fact, I'm pretty sure we had him on a past theater talk when he won a Wild Award for Best New Script for a play he wrote called Night of the Stars, which is about Tennessee Williams. He has a new play called Dancing, and it is in a premiere run at Planet Ant in Hamtramck. And Dancing is about 2 young women. At the start of the play, they're 17. By the end, they're about 22. They're on their own. We hear about some family, but these girls are really on their own with little means of support. It's a very intimate play. Lots of conversation between the two, but very little is as it seems. And there isn't a whole lot else I can say because I don't want to leak any spoilers on the play.
So there are surprises.
But let me say this. Yeah. I'm not a kid anymore. We're not kids.
Yeah.
These girls are about the same age as my son, though. And the chatter between 2 teenagers is not always riveting for people of our generation, okay? But I found myself caring quite a lot about these characters. Maybe because I do have a son that's about this age, but it's a play with a bit of a secret that audience members, some of them, will figure out before it's revealed towards the end of the play. And even when you know what that secret is, it allows you to switch gears a bit and maybe focus on one of the characters a bit more. My test of a play is how much do I care about these characters and what happens to them? That's crucial.
That would make sense.
And in that respect, the playwright and the director, who's Caitlin Ballard-Bourque, and the two actresses succeed very much. So that's at Planet Ant, and it runs for a few more weeks. So I encourage people to check it out. He's a very interesting new playwright who's had some success, and he's homegrown. So
and we'll watch and see it, when he's starting off so strong, so young, it'll be fascinating to see where Max goes in his playwriting career. Okay. Now we head up I-75 to Flint. What's going on at the Flint Rep?
For something completely different,
yeah,
as they say. So we've been talking about, you know, holiday shows the last two theater talks. But the Flint Rep is doing Into the Woods.
I wish it's not for me, it's for my granny in the woods. A loaf of bread, please, to bring my poor old hungry granny in the woods. Just a loaf of bread, please.
And, so this is the Sondheim musical that is based on intertwining characters from the Brothers Grimm fairy tales and those by Charles Perrault. That means you have Cinderella, the baker and the baker's wife, Little Red Riding Hood, Rapunzel, the witch,
Jack and the Beanstalk,
and more. So the music is beautiful. It's become a very strong seller in regional theater because of its appeal to multi-generational audiences. And because parents and grandparents, you know, can take the kids. Everybody has a good time.
So the Flint Rep giving everybody a little break from maybe Bob Cratchit and Ebenezer Scrooge and bringing us Into the Woods, which is really, as you say, it's a very fun show we can all enjoy. Now we wind up at the Michigan Irish Repertory Theater.
Right. And full disclosure, that's my very nascent company. We're the little engine that could, but it is the only Irish rep in the state. So we're doing the Dylan Thomas classic that was originally produced and created by the New York Irish Rep. And what this show is a blending of Dylan Thomas's story, A Child's Christmas in Wales, which is about his family, and traditional Christmas songs sung in English and some in the Welsh. And I want to treat the audience a little bit of Beth Mitchell, who's one of our cast members, singing a bit of the Welsh for this weekend's shows.
Kudos to her. This is not like singing, you know, something that maybe you took in high school, like Spanish or French.
Well, fortunately, Beth is an opera singer, so she's used to singing in different languages.
Right.
So she was chosen very, very carefully for this. So Saturday afternoon, we're at the Carytown Concert House, and Sunday afternoon at the Michigan League. Details and ticket links are at Encore. But we also have at the top of the site as a service to our readers, is a guide to all the holiday shows that we know about in the professional theater world. So if you want to see a Scrooge or some rendition of the Scrooge story or It's a Wonderful Life or A Child's Christmas in Wales, we have a handy guide at the top of the site for all your theater wants and needs.
And of course, that site would be EncoreMichigan.com, and you ought to bookmark that because that's where you can follow the happenings of theater companies all around Michigan. Well, David, this is our 50th theater talk. I count them as we do them.
Wow, that's great.
Number 50, our last one together as I retire at the end of next week. And I want to thank you for everything you do. You shine a light on the many wonderful theater companies around the state, but also the producers, the actors. And I know it's a labor of love for you.
Cynthia, we all want to thank you because this show and your leadership of it and your hosting of it allows us to celebrate Michigan and what we love about it, what interests us about it, and why we live here so many different ways. we're very thankful, and we wish you only the happiest of retirements with your family.
Thank you. And if you're in Cork sometime, I may be there. You let me know, and we'll go to the Corkadorka or one of the theaters.
Go to the Cork Arts Theater, because I have a little bit of a transatlantic alliance with them for the Michigan Irish Rep.
We'll do that. Thank you so much, David. Have a great holiday.
Thank you, Cynthia. You too.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's play pretend. Pretend it's 60 years ago, December 1959, and you're going downtown Detroit to do some holiday shopping on Woodward Avenue.
Here is the Pioneer Department Store that is now one of the largest in the country, where you could get anything from the furs you came to these shores for in the first place to 10,000 other items you never heard of.
Birthdays, parties, and proms were just some of the occasions which brought Detroit families downtown to shop, with the biggest crowds coming for the parade.
The sun is coming out. It's shining down brightly here on Woodward Avenue in Detroit, and here comes the J.L. Hudson Thanksgiving Day Parade.
We didn't start Christmas or even start shopping at Christmas time until Santa had arrived in the Hudson Parade. It was a treat to go down to see Santa.
This band has been featured for three consecutive years at the Detroit Lions football games at Tiger Stadium. Let's listen to it for a minute.
What was it about that downtown department store, a store like the Big Hudson's, that seems so magical? And why did these stores fade into oblivion? What does it say about the way we shop in 2019? Well, Michael Hauser here to talk about that. He's the author of Hudson's, Detroit's legendary department store. He's also the marketing manager for the Detroit Opera House. And Michael, you once worked for Hudson's?
I did. I worked for, well, under all three regimes, Hudson's, Marshall Field's, and Macy's.
Oh, you've been through it all. So here we are. It's December 1959. Walk me down Woodward Avenue. What will I see?
During the holidays, of course, all of the windows on Woodward Avenue would be animated, appealing to children's fantasies. You'd have a 9-story tree of lights on the Woodward Avenue facade of the building. The minute you came in, of course, you'd be greeted by elevator hostesses who could whisk you up to the 12th floor where Santa was ensconced, or you could go to 13 where all the restaurants were. There were also pop-up shops on some of the elevators, long before we knew what a pop-up shop was, of course. Mm. On the 12th floor, of course, you would be greeted by pixies who were Santa's helpers to whisk you through the magic forest on the way to see Santa. And then you could go into the auditorium. Each year, the auditorium had a different theme regarding the holidays. And then, of course, there was a Christmas carnival for the kids on the Farmer Street side of the 12th floor.
My goodness. Not to mention, you can't even count how many different products were for sale at that downtown Hudson's. And there were some other big, big stores, department stores, that Detroiters shopped at downtown. What were some of those?
Well, of course, Crowley's, which was on Gratiot. The other side of Hudson's, which also was a large department store that a lot of people loved. 1959 also would have been the last Christmas for Kearns, which was another large department store just south of Hudson's. People still today can meet under the Kearns clock right in front of One Campus Martius.
That's true. It's still there. For people who are too young to remember, that was kind of the big meeting place when you went downtown. I was one of those kids whose mom brought them downtown for the shopping. I remember vividly as a little kid walking in front of those incredibly decorated windows. And then there was always the chestnut man outside. He had his cart with hot steaming chestnuts for sale that you could munch as you walked around downtown. And then there were a lot of great stores like Grinnell's. I would always go buy sheet music because I played the piano. As a child, I felt like I was in like a Fred Astaire movie. It felt like big New York City.
It was. Besides the department stores, you had all the specialty stores, mm-hmm. the clothing stores, the jewelry stores, the shoe stores, and of course the large dime stores like Kresge and Woolworth.
Yes, yes. You know, interesting, as you mentioned, the Santa Land on the 12th floor at the downtown Hudson's. How many kids might go through that in a given holiday season?
In a given holiday season, over 200,000 children would sit on Santa's lap. They'd be lined up for several floors at a time, especially on the weekends. Now, of course, everybody thought that they were seeing the real Santa. But with that many children coming through, obviously different partitions, on the weekends there would be half a dozen Santas working.
Well, here's something that I think I remember, and tell me if I'm right, that there was a choice of Santas, that there would be an African-American Santa, there was an Hispanic Santa, and a Caucasian Santa.
Right. Hudson's was one of the first stores. This is about by 1970 or so. Hudson's was one of the first major stores in the country to offer you a choice of Santa.
And wasn't there some kind of an exposition area within the store?
Well, the auditorium, mm-hmm. which, you know, for many, many years, when you stop and think about it, the auditorium was really sort of a precursor to a convention center. It was like a civic center of its time because you went there for fashion shows, flower shows, holiday shows, auto shows,
bridal
cat shows,
dog
shows, bridal shows. And you have to remember, too, Hudson's was the only department store to ever be involved with an automobile company, the Hudson Motor Car Company. And so the Hudson Motor Cars, when they were introduced each fall, were not introduced at, you know, in a setting like Cobo Center, or what we call TCF Center today, but on the selling floors of Hudson's.
Hudson's closed that downtown store in January of 1983, and then the building was imploded on October 24th, 1998. I remember covering that for TV. You can't blame that on online shopping. So what happened? Why did it go away?
Well, changing demographics, not as many people working downtown as there used to be. You know, the best year in sales for the downtown store was 1952. About $150 million in sales. And you put that into today's economy, you're really talking about $1 billion worth of sales out of just that store. But by 1982, the last full year of operation, that had dropped to about $40 million. And, you know, it was costing several million just to heat and air condition the building. I mean, they tried everything they could right up through the end, you know, consolidating floor space, adding special events. But with less people working downtown, less people coming downtown, you know, it just wasn't in the cards. It was one of the last big downtown stores, you know, in the country to actually still be open aside from, you know, New York, Chicago, and San Francisco.
And of course, Detroiters, Metro Detroiters had the malls. They ringed Metro Detroit's, you know, Northland, Eastland, Westland, Southland, Oakland Mall. And then in the late 70s, added in Fairlane, 12 Oaks, and Lakeside. And then, of course, there was Somerset Mall in Troy. That was a little different because it was high-end, Saks Fifth Avenue, Bonwit Teller. But those malls now, it's kind of interesting how, you know, history repeats itself. They're struggling, some of them.
Right. And it's not just internet shopping. Some of it is, you know, retail itself. Too many stores that are too much alike, selling the same merchandise, too many sales, too many coupons, too many savings passes, lack of customer service, you know, cutbacks in sales associates on the floor, lack of product knowledge because of no training. You know, it's a whole plethora of things that have contributed to where we're at today.
Walk us along Woodward now. So here we are 60 years later, and after many years of empty storefronts, Woodward is filling up again with what? Give us a kind of a sampling.
Well, it's interesting. And a lot of this, of course, is thanks to Bedrock.
Dan Gilbert, yeah.
Dan Gilbert. Where Kresge's was is Under Armour. Where Woolworth was is Nike. Where Moose Jaw is was Crosby Shoes. Where Warby Parker and Lululemon are were Chandler's Shoes. Where H&M is actually is three different buildings: Richmond Brothers Clothing, Grinnell Brothers, which you earlier mentioned, and then Bond Clothiers. All three buildings plus lower level.
Interesting. So,
and then where Wright K. Jewelers was, of course, is John Varvatos.
Yes, and with a restaurant above him, yes.
Right, you've got niche retailing. H&M is really, I think, the game changer because it appeals to such a wide demographic, and it's also more popular priced.
And just briefly, how does Woodward Avenue, this arc we've talked about, how does it reflect the story of department stores around the country?
Well, there's not too many downtowns left where you really can experience what we had many moons ago. Obviously, New York, State Street in Chicago, Union Square in San Francisco, Downtown Crossing in Boston. Mm. That's really about it in terms of still having big downtown stores, a lot of special events to go along with it. I was just on State Street yesterday.
Yes.
And what used to be Marshall Field's, of course, is Macy's on State today.
Correct.
And it was a two-hour wait to get into the Walnut Room. There were people lined up for Holiday Lane, people lined up for Santa, people lined up, you know, to see all the animated windows. The store was, you know, beautifully decorated. It just gave you that feeling of, you know, what you grew up with, but it's still here.
Absolutely. Yes. Right. There we go. Everything old is new again, and people still crave that. Michael Hauser's book is Hudson's, Detroit's Legendary Department Store. Thank you so much, Michael. It was great reliving those years with you.
Thank you, and happy holidays, everybody.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Noise, noise, noise. More than just a nuisance. The onslaught of 21st century noise is hazardous to our health. But it's tough to convince policymakers of this threat because you can't see it, you can't smell it. And it's hard to measure just how much noise each of us is exposed to. That has led Apple to partner with the University of Michigan. The goal? Measure how much sound that we are being exposed to. Richard Neitzel is leading this research effort at U of M. He's an associate professor of environmental health sciences and of global public health at U of M School of Public Health. Good to have you with us, Richard.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have been studying noise pollution for some 20 years or so.
More than I care to think of at this point, but yes, 20 or so.
What is noise pollution? Give us some examples.
So noise pollution is just sound in the environment that we don't want or that is harmful to us. So that can include things like aircraft, buses, cars, your neighbor's noisy dog, the Amtrak going by in the middle of the night, and everything in between.
Leaf blowers.
Absolutely. Yes, in fact, yard maintenance equipment are typically right up at the top in terms of annoyance. But I don't just study annoyance. I'm more interested in direct impacts on people's health.
What do most of us not understand about what all this noise exposure is doing to our health?
I think most of us will acknowledge, if pushed, that too much noise probably causes hearing loss, and that's absolutely correct. But what we're learning, particularly in the last couple decades, is that hearing loss may just be the tip of the iceberg. There's an increasing body of evidence that links noise to heart attacks, to hypertension, potentially to stroke, to cognitive impacts, perhaps mental health impacts as well. So as we learn more and more about noise, we're realizing that really hearing loss is just one of a whole host of things, all of which are harmful to our health. The disruption of sleep is one mechanism that noise may harm our health through. So we know absolutely that if you don't sleep well, that puts you at much elevated risk for things like hypertension and heart attacks. But we also find hypertension and heart attacks among workers. And most workers don't get paid to sleep on the job. So there's something else at play here. And it turns out that noise is a general stressor of your system as well. So even if you're not realizing it, that noise exposure is activating your fight or flight reflex. You're having an adrenal response, and that releases hormones that can lead again directly to things like heart attack.
Looking at Michigan, how much noise pollution do we have in our state?
Well, so one of the problems we have is that we don't have good data on this. In fact, it's only been in the last couple of years that we've started to generate maps of where noise is in the United States, Michigan included. And these maps are useful, but they're very limited. So they come from the Department of Transportation, and they focus specifically on roadways and aircraft. And those are two important sources of noise, but they're not the only sources of noise. So where we've really fallen down is knowing how you and I and our individual behaviors might add to that background aircraft and roadway noise. Do you have a noisy job? Do you shoot guns? Do you have other noisy hobbies? So this has been a black box forever because we simply haven't had the ability to make measurements at the individual level on a large enough group of people to say how much noise do Michiganders or Americans have.
So what is this study about? How are you working with Apple?
So Apple is funding this study with the University of Michigan, and we're partnering to look at what we hope is a very large sample of people, and we're taking advantage of technology that's really available for the first time. So using their iPhone, people will be able basically to measure how much exposure they get to music through their headphones. And this has been sort of the holy grail for understanding noise exposure forever. We've never had good tools to do that. Now, for the first time, we will. People who have an Apple Watch will also be able to contribute information about their surrounding noise levels. So now, for the first time, if people have an Apple Watch and a phone, we can get a sense of what their total noise exposure is for all the things they do during the day, including listening to music. This is groundbreaking.
And how would this work then? I mean, would you have an app, and would the app be listening, air quotes?
So this is absolutely a voluntary study, so people consent into this. In fact, Apple has created something called the Research app. And so if people download this Research app onto their iPhone, they'll then have an opportunity to review this and two other studies. And if they choose to participate, they can, again, choose to share certain types of information with Apple. Now, we are absolutely committed to maintaining privacy. Apple, in fact, never has information to people's identifying information. That's only available to us at the University of Michigan. But what people are sharing is the sound levels from their watch, the music listening levels from their iPhone. And then another critical piece of this is the app will allow them to test their hearing from time to time. So really, we can start to connect their exposures to their health impacts. The watch also enables us to measure people's heart rate. So we can start to connect noise to a cardiovascular outcome.
So you're going to get clearer scientific data than you've ever had before.
Absolutely. We are kind of moving the scientific frontier forward here. The technology and the software available to us now are allowing us to do things that I, as a researcher, have wanted to do for 20 years but have simply been impossible.
What could this mean in terms of policy decisions or things that policymakers could use to perhaps mitigate this?
So I actually see two major benefits out of the study. We'll come back to policy in a second. One of the benefits is to the individual. So as you participate in the study, you're going to get feedback on your own exposures. You may choose, ideally, to modify your exposures if you're getting too much noise and potentially putting yourself at risk. So that's the individual benefit, which is huge, I think. From a policy perspective, we'll now have at a national level an idea of what Americans are actually exposed to. This has always been guesses and supposition before. We'll have data now. And we'll have data not only on exposure, but on hearing impacts and on heart rate. So we'll be able to give policymakers for the first time a very comprehensive view of what noise is doing to public health, and ideally also give them recommendations about where do people seem to be getting their exposure from, what could be modified from a policy level to better protect public health.
Based on the research you have done, and understanding that it's going to be greatly advanced by this partnership with Apple, but what do we know, Richard, as far as which communities tend to be more affected by noise pollution?
Unfortunately, the research in this country is pretty sparse. We basically stepped out of the noise research field in about 1981.
Why did we do that?
So the Office of Noise Abatement and Control at our Environmental Protection Agency exists solely to study noise and make America quieter. And it was one of the first actions of the Reagan administration to defund that office. The office still exists on paper. They passed laws that are still in place, but there's nobody at home to enforce them. But we do know from other types of research, a number of things. So we know that people who live in dense urban areas tend to have more noise. So the more people we crowd into a certain footprint, the more noise there's going to be. We also know that people who tend to live closer to transportation, a transit center, an airport, a seaport, they tend to have more noise. Further, we know that communities that tend to be low income and people of color also tend to have more noise, as well as many other environmental hazards. There are definitely subgroups among us who have more exposure than the typical American.
We know, just kind of thinking around, of stories that we've seen in Michigan, that sound walls are being built along some freeways. Ann Arbor has banned certain leaf blowers and outdoor equipment. Some houses in Detroit are being upgraded to mitigate the noise that will be coming from the Gordie Howe International Bridge. And a lot of communities have the ordinances that allow people to file complaints about noise pollution. Are these kind of grassroots efforts like this, is it enough to make a difference?
I have to believe that it absolutely is. I do want to come back to this idea of the Environmental Protection Agency. So we do have this federal office that was intentionally created to coordinate these activities, to sort of build on the grassroots, but also have some top-down approaches. We actually have the political infrastructure in place to do a better job here. One other thing that's missing is just general public awareness. I think if people understood that this exposure was so common and so harmful, that might sort of entice them to be a bit more activist about this. But you're absolutely right. There are a number of local and state efforts in place, many of which have made dramatic improvements. We just need more.
What are the challenges in local enforcement?
Local enforcement is difficult. Some cities, for example, I used to live in the city of Seattle, had an ordinance that was enforceable by the police department. And the police department would actually carry a sound level meter in their cars. And so if there was a noise complaint, they could actually objectively evaluate the complaint and confirm if it was or was not a violation of the ordinance. Not a lot of communities have the resources to have all of their police officers also doing environmental health measurements. That's a challenge, too. Another issue is for things like sound walls, as you said, they can be incredibly effective, but they're very expensive. And so the notion of a small municipality collecting enough funds to build a sound wall is probably out of reach for most governments, which, again, is where the federal government can step in. And in fact, in some cases, big federal projects will require the implementation of noise controls. I find there's a sweet spot between there where there may be some grassroots efforts that can tap into existing federal or state resources to sort of maximize the opportunities there.
And speaking of the state, are there actions that can be taken at a state level? Because especially right now the way that things stand for the Environmental Protection Agency right now, a lot of these environmental protections are being unwound by the Trump administration.
So true and so very, very unfortunate. Let me actually give you a positive story here. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, lots of Americans were getting angry about a new noise source then, air traffic, specifically jet aircraft, to the point where there were many studies done that confirmed exactly what noise level it took to annoy exactly what fraction of the population. We know a lot about this. And America got upset about this, and they complained, and the politicians did something about it. They told aircraft manufacturers, we don't care how you do it, but you are going to make your airplanes quieter, or they will no longer be able to fly in the United States. And there was a lot of dismay among the manufacturers, and then they figured it out. And as a result, we have about 95% fewer people overexposed to aircraft noise today than we did in the 1980s. That's huge, and it was a direct result of the federal government saying, we don't want to leave this to the states. We're actually going to pass a regulation, and we're going to force technology to adapt to make America quieter. It's worked before. It could absolutely work again. The problem is the states don't have the authority to regulate sources like that. What states can do, though, is implement educational campaigns, again, to raise awareness. They could perhaps think about allocating resources to noise control. You mentioned the Gordie Howe Bridge. That's absolutely an example of state and international partnership. So I think the states have a role here, as do local governments, and unfortunately, the federal government must act as well.
Well, fascinating work. Richard Neitzel, who's an associate professor of environmental health sciences and of global public health at U of M School of Public Health, partnering with Apple to measure just how much sound we're all being exposed to. Great talking with you. Thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
The glorious and powerful Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in D minor, his final complete symphony. It's one of the greatest paradoxes in music that when Ludwig von Beethoven was writing these beautiful passages, he was profoundly deaf, and he'd suffered for years from a litany of illnesses and ailments. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here with us. So this month marks Beethoven's 249th birthday. Happy birthday, Ludwig.
Yep.
But boy, he had some unhappy years because of his health.
He had so many ailments aside from his legendary deafness. You know, he had a bad stomach, he had digestive problems, he suffered from chronic diarrhea, he had respiratory problems. He drank quite a bit and probably had liver failure as a result of cirrhosis because he drank so much wine so heavily. And of course, he had depression, which is sort of goes hand in hand with alcoholism, on top of being a superb pianist and conductor and composer who couldn't hear a note.
When did he begin to lose his hearing?
He was a young man. He was about 27 or 28 when it started. And by the time he was 45, he could no longer hear anything.
Well, medical detectives have been trying to figure out what caused all the illnesses and his hearing loss. And modern-day testing figured into that quest. Someone bought a lock of Beethoven's hair?
Yeah. Apparently, a man named Hiller, who was a violinist, came to visit Beethoven on his deathbed. He asked for and clipped a lock of his hair, which was a very common thing that people did for those they loved. They would take a lock of their hair and put it in a locket and save it. And that stayed in the Hiller family until roughly around the 1940s. It somehow got to Denmark, and a physician got a hold of it. He may have been paid in hair, or it may have been a gift. And later on, the family sold it at Sotheby's in 1994, and a urologist bought it for about $7,000. They put it through the hair through a battery of forensic tests, x-ray tests, toxicology tests, and for the most part, it really didn't show much of anything. There was no evidence of syphilis, for example, which is one of the theories behind his ailments. There was no mercury poisoning, but there was a very high lead level. He probably drank out of a goblet that was fashioned from lead, and a lot of the wine of the era was sweetened with lead. The reason why children, for example, like lead paint chips, we've actually discussed
yes.
it, as it tastes like little candy. It's sweet. And so lead was a common sweetener for wine, so that may have been the source as well. And it can cause hearing problems and even deafness.
So that could have all kind of fit in. But as far as all of the myriad of other problems, is it a recognizable syndrome to have had all these?
Well, yeah, maybe, maybe not. There was a syndrome that I had to actually look up that's called Cogan's syndrome. It's an autoimmune inflammatory disorder. And indeed, that could all link in his belly problems, his liver problems, and his hearing problems. But then again, who knows? Because there's no tissue other than this hair, there's no real autopsy other than the one that was performed that said he had a cirrhotic liver. Drinking a lot is not a good thing.
And if it's got lead in it, even less of a good
thing.
Right,
yeah.
So as you write that here we have again a famous death and no clear definitive diagnosis and pretty common condition in medical history. And speaking of medical history, you have a new book coming out, Literatum Essays at the Intersection of Medicine and Culture. 81 of your essays on medicine and the medical issues of all sorts of interesting people. What are some of your favorites?
Well, as a baseball fan, I loved writing about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Babe Ruth was one of the first cancer patients to get a experimental drug that we now give quite routinely. And Lou Gehrig may not have died of Lou Gehrig's disease. He may have just been hit in the head too many times by baseballs and bats. So that was kind of fun. I liked writing about presidential health because for some reason people love presidents and they love death. And so dead presidents is really a boffo way to get people's attention.
You are a pediatrician by trade. You teach at the U of M Medical School. So when and how and why did you get into this area of medical history and medical detective work?
Well, I got into medical history as a medical student, and I had a wonderful teacher here at Michigan named Horace Davenport, who was a famous physiologist. He actually discovered why the stomach doesn't digest itself. I was a recovering English major, and you know the first few years of medical school are just memorization and terrible. And so he was working on a history of the medical school, and I didn't even know medical history existed before that point. And then I went on. He actually told me, you know, you're going to have to get a PhD. That's the last thing a medical student wants to hear when they're in the thick of medical studies. But I indeed did that at Johns Hopkins and then came back to Michigan. I've been studying medical history ever since. It's been a wonderful career.
How much digging around in research does it take for you to write, let's say, the infectious disease that sprung Al Capone from Alcatraz or the medical history that helped make Thomas Edison an inventor?
Well, it depends on the topic and it also depends on the source. So if I'm writing one of my books, for example, I tend to do a great deal of primary research of looking at documents in archives, piecing things together. If people are alive, I'll do oral history interviews and so on. When I'm writing for a news source, whether it's the New York Times or PBS, I have to be far faster because there's a deadline that's looming. And so the wonderful thing about writing about anything, today, particularly history, is that you carry the world's greatest library in your pocket. So in the olden days, I would have to go to the library and look up things on microfilm and so on. And so many things are now available on the internet and the World Wide Web that I frequently write these PBS columns over my weekends.
That's amazing. Well, I have so enjoyed talking medical history with you through these years on Statesides. For someone who once thought she would be a physician and then thought she would be a history professor and became neither, it has been a treat to be able to tick off both boxes every time we talk. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, I want to thank you. The treat has been all mine. Thanks so much. And I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so very much.
And we're going to miss you.
Ah, thank you. Dr. Howard Markel, University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, and the new book, Literati: Essays at the Intersection of Medicine and Culture. Howard, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Stateside, postpartum mood disorders, taking better care of moms and their mental health. Tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.